Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On the 4th of July, Donald Trump signed the GOP budget bill with a military jet flyover. The Republican bill is the largest transfer of wealth from the poor and working class to the rich in U.S. history. Republicans voted for the largest cuts to Medicaid and SNAP in U.S. history to fund massive tax cuts for the wealthy, ICE, and the military. 17 million people will lose their health insurance. 2 million people will lose access to food assistance programs, and that'll help fund a $170 billion initiative to, quote, supercharge immigration enforcement, $150 billion for the military, and $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for corporations and the ultra-wealthy. The bill will add $3.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. So what do you want to know about this bill? Today, we will discuss the details of the bill, and tomorrow, because so many people are so concerned about what's to come, we will find out how social service advocates in California are preparing. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by three guests. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible, an organization that was founded in response to Trump's Electoral College victory back in 2016. More than a million members are working to resist the GOP's agenda, elect local leaders, and fight for progressive policies. Ezra Levin is co-author of the 2019 book, We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. He previously served as associate director of federal policy for Prosperity Now, a national anti-poverty nonprofit, and as deputy policy director for Congressman Lloyd Doggett, a Democrat from Texas. Hi, Ezra. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Shelby Gonzalez is Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where she leads the center's work related to access to public benefits and other support for immigrants and their families. From 2011 to 2015, Shelby Gonzalez served as a member of the Advisory Panel on Outreach and Education, which provides expertise to the Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator on matters related to education. She currently sits on the Commonwealth of Virginia's Children Health Insurance Program Advisory Committee and is on the Executive Committee for the Protecting Immigrant Families Coalition. Hi, Shelby. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rosa. So happy to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Will Rice, Research Director and Policy Consultant for Americans for Tax Fairness. They fight to build an economy that works for all by making the wealthy and big corporations pay their fair share in taxes. Over the past 20 years, Will Rice has worked for progressive causes and candidates in the National Capital Area and in New England. Hi, Will. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very glad to be here.
Well, it's great. I'm very glad to have all of you. So to think that this is the largest transfer of wealth from the poor and working class to the rich in history. And I was just reading about children. I would love to ask listeners, what percentage of children do you think are on Medicaid? I asked a couple friends and they said 20. It's actually 40, almost 50. So almost half of the children in this country are on Medicaid. And to qualify for Medicaid, you have to have a very low income. Ezra, I think what this bill shows is that a lot of people in this country are really struggling. And sadly, because of these cuts, things are just going to get worse.
That's really true. And what is also true is this administration and this Congress had no mandate for this. Look, Trump won a plurality of the popular vote. He won the election, and he won by a lot of voters who weren't happy with the status quo. They wanted cheaper prices for eggs and gas. They didn't just want more of the same. They weren't voting for Medicaid cuts. The polling in the lead up to this bill tested how popular is cutting Medicaid across the country and looked at every congressional district in this country. In the deepest red districts in America. Cutting Medicaid has a 15% approval rating. It is not a policy agenda that has any substantial support across the country, even in red and rural areas. And I think a lot of voters across the country are going to look at this and say, this is not what I was looking for, because their lives are about to get, unfortunately, a lot worse.
Well, and if you do have friends in living in states where Medicaid may have a different name, you might want to let them know that they're about to lose their coverage, because Abigail Ruman on NPR had this very important piece called Medicaid's Many Different Names May Cause Confusion About Who's Losing Coverage. And so in many states across the country, it's not called Medicaid. It might be called something else, like the Indiana Children's Health Insurance Program. In Georgia, it's Peach Care for Kids. So a lot of people have no idea what's coming. Will, what are your thoughts, your overall thoughts about this bill, now that you've been able to really take a look and find out what's in it? I mean, it's so long, it's 1,000 pages long.
Yeah, well, I think your introductory statement is a very good one and accurate, that it is the biggest transfer of wealth from working families to the very top of the income and wealth scale. We put out a report a few weeks ago that argued that, in fact, most people are going to be worse off after this bill than they were before it, and by which we mean the bottom 60% of the American people. And that's taking into account the parts of the tax bill, like the no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, that in theory, or anyway, are supposed to be targeted towards working people. But when you add in the loss of services and President Trump's ever fluctuating tariff policy, most people are going to be facing higher costs, not enjoying a tax cut after this bill comes into effect.
And I think it's also important, and over the next few weeks, we're going to do a lot of deep dives into this just to let people know what's coming. The Los Angeles Times had a good piece called "The Healthcare Cuts Approved by Trump Go Well Beyond Medicaid." They report that Covered California, this is our state's Affordable Care Act health insurance marketplace, estimates that as many as 660,000 of the roughly 2 million people in the program will either be stripped of their coverage or drop out due to increased costs and erroneous new mandates. Those who do stay could be hit with an average monthly premium increase of up to 66%. So I know people who are paying $1,000 a month for health coverage. How are they going to be able to afford a 66% increase? So this bill is so massive, and it's going to hit people who might not right now think they're going to be hit. And again, I just want to emphasize, I know a lot of people are afraid of what's to come, and we are also going to be talking to advocates about how they're preparing, because you can't even imagine. Let's say someone, they're so sick right now, and what are they going to do when this healthcare goes away? And well, we're going to talk about the timeline, but of course, the Republicans decided to implement the tax cuts right away. Is that right, Will? But with the Medicaid cuts, it's going to happen after next year's midterms.
That's right. It's one of many kind of budget gimmicks that Republicans have tried through the years. The reason that this was such a big deal this year, the urgency, was that when they were last in control, President Trump and the Republicans in Congress, and they passed their big 2017 tax and spending bill, they made all of the corporate tax cuts permanent, but they made the individual tax cuts temporary, and they were going to run out at the end of this year. So, and that was purely a budget gimmick to make the bill appear to be less expensive than it really was, so they could give even larger tax cuts to big corporations.
So basically, the only way to deal with that and reverse that is if Democrats win in 4 years, they will have to pass a bill to reverse those tax cuts.
That's right. And I think, based on the way public opinion has been moving in recent years, there's a very good chance that they'll do that. If Democrats control the White House and both chambers of Congress, there are a lot of really good progressive tax changes that could be implemented that would demand much more from large corporations and the wealthiest households, and use that money to actually lower costs for working people rather than raising them like this bill is going to do.
Shelby, what are your thoughts overall? We'll talk about the massive increase to ICE in a minute, because that's not getting as much attention as the Medicaid cuts. I mean, it all deserves attention, but you have done a lot of work around Medicare and Medicaid. So what really hits you the hardest when you look at this bill?
Well, there's so much that hits me pretty hard, I feel, in some ways, when I think about all of the people who are going to be losing coverage. It is shocking to think about how that's going to impact lots of different places, starting with some of the more vulnerable locations in our country, where there's in rural locations, where hospital systems have so many of the patients that they serve on a daily basis, depend on Medicaid as their coverage provider. Lots of points that you made earlier. In some cases, some of the coverage losses in Medicaid are going to take a little while before people start seeing them impact them on an individual basis. But some of these healthcare entities that will be negatively impacted have to project out, you know, many, many, many months in advance. So you could start seeing clinics and hospitals and other providers having to make changes to forecast what's to come. Another group that we'll be seeing in terms of coverage losses quite soon, you talked about, you know, your friends that get coverage on the ACA marketplace. They will begin seeing huge, huge hikes in their premiums, and the costs that they pay for their health coverage starting next year, starting in January. They'll start seeing those increases when they start the enrollment process for the fall, for the next year. So come this November, people will begin seeing just how unaffordable coverage becomes under this bill. And then one other thing, and I know that I should mention that my area of expertise within immigration, although I can talk a little bit about this bill, really kind of looks at the intersection of public benefits and programs that impact people with low and moderate incomes, and as it relates to people who are immigrants. So I kind of live within that intersection. Mm-hmm. And one group in particular that I'm very concerned about are people who are going to begin losing access to food assistance quite soon. In particular, there are some severe restrictions in SNAP benefits that help people make groceries affordable to them. We could see people that are refugees, people who are granted asylum, and other groups that have been here with humanitarian protections for many years lose access to food, lose access to Medicaid, lose access to Medicare, lose access to ACA. There's huge cuts in eligibility that are harming people who have been granted humanitarian protections in our nation for a very long time.
And Shelby, since you brought up food assistance, I think it's so important to really focus on the fact that even before this bill passed, people were really struggling in this country. NPR had a piece, and we're going to do a whole show about this. There's just so much to unpack here. The health of children in the United States has declined significantly since the year 2007. They found that a U.S. child was 15 to 20% more likely to have a chronic condition in 2023 than a child in 2011. So we're talking about depression, anxiety, sleep, apnea, obesity, autism. So there's that. And then Axios reporter Emily Peck had a really important piece over the weekend about the increasing share of U.S. adults going hungry. And when you think, Shelby, about what happened under COVID and those desperately needed pieces of legislation that increase funding for hunger programs, that gave people the child tax credit, I mean, these were life-changing programs. I remember the New York Times had a piece about this woman who works at a gas station, and she was just so grateful that she could take her son out to lunch and buy him new shoes. We just don't talk enough about these people who are struggling so much in this country. And then after COVID, all of that got taken away, and here we are with this bill. So we need through lines with all of this. Even before this bill, people were struggling so much. And again, it's just a reality. Things are just going to get worse for so many people, Shelby.
Yeah. And, you know, the communities across our nation, it's amazing that we have different entities that oftentimes come in and help in one way or the other. For example, food banks, right? They play a huge important role, but they're not going to be able to absorb what's coming. They're not going to be able to, absorb millions of people losing access to SNAP. The number of individuals who are no longer going to be able to access food assistance through SNAP can't be absorbed through the different entities that are there to kind of pick up the pieces and to help people that are struggling. So I think the struggle is very real and it's coming quite soon.
And just to give listeners numbers here, Axios reported on a report from Morning Consult. They found that in May, 15.6% of adults were food insecure. This is a term that is used now broadly. It just means that people don't have enough to eat. That's almost double the rate of 2021. Demand for food is up 120% from 3 years ago at a Philadelphia area food bank network. Ezra, I mean, again, it's just a fact. Republicans are creating a society in which the most vulnerable have no choice but to rely on maybe a church or a community group or a food bank. But as Shelby said, there's no possible way that they're going to be able to fill the gap.
Look, budgets are moral documents. You put your values in those budgets. And the Republicans in Congress have told us exactly who they are. They believe that the number one problem facing our society today is that the rich just don't have enough money. And we need to cut their taxes so they can have more money. They believe that number two problem is that lower income and working class Americans they have it too easy. They've got it too easy from the government, and we've got to cut those services because that's the just society that they want to live in. Look, that is a political ideology. I understand it. I strongly disagree with it, but I understand it. I think the questions for Americans around the country is that an ideology that they want to support? Or do they want to elect representatives who disagree with that, who believe that maybe wealth inequality being at historic highs and income inequality being at historic highs is itself a problem, and that working class Americans have it too hard? Because I believe the vast majority of Americans actually share that set of political beliefs and are looking to make life easier for them. And that's going to play out in the future. But I hope people don't purely just turn to what does this mean for the next elections? What does this mean 16 months from now for the midterms? Because this is going to start impacting families right now, not just the Medicaid and SNAP cuts, but also this deportation regime, this secret police that's been funded to the hilt. That's going to show up in American communities in the coming weeks. We all saw what this administration has done to LA, its militarization, its terror that it's wreaked across the city of LA. The reason why ICE hasn't executed a similar play in other communities is because they haven't had the money yet, Rose, but they do now. They do now. They funded the secret police through ICE and the rest of the Department of Homeland Security at a level that is just doesn't have a parallel in American history. ICE is now the largest federal law enforcement agency in the country, dwarfing the size of the FBI and other agencies. And that's not funding that's going to come through in 2026 or 2027. That's funding that comes through now. ICE is going to go on a hiring spree. They're going to be building detention camps around the country. And we're going to see what they did in LA replicated in places like Seattle and San Francisco and New York and Chicago and Austin, because now they've got the funds to do it. And I hope people aren't just thinking about this bill in terms of future impact or in terms of electoral consequence. They should be thinking about, how is this going to impact my community? And how can I connect with the most vulnerable members of my community and others to start pushing back against this rampant federal overreach?
So Ezra, to your point, Politico has a piece about all of this. So this is, in this bill, there's $170 billion for border and immigration enforcement. So to further militarize the border, and as you say, hire so many more people. So Tom Homan, who is Trump's border czar, said, quote, told Politico on Friday, look, this isn't easy. 10,000 ICE officers never happened before. But I'll say this, it's about time. With more money, we can do more. So Homan says they're going to spend this money by the end of Trump's term. Cannot predict how long it will take for the administration to deport 1 million people. He's working with ICE to assess how many new agents they can hire over the next 3 months. And as you say, how quickly they can bring on new detention beds. Yeah. And according to this piece, Homan said, ICE is on a constant chase, trying to move flights out as quickly as possible just to make room for the arrests they're making. They're averaging 1,500 to 2,000 a day. He said teams are coming home before the end of a shift because of the lack of beds. So the beds are going to get us more capability for detention. That's the big thing. So as you laid out there, Ezra, they're going to move so quickly to get more planes, to fly people out, to get more beds, and to make sure that more ICE agents are in more parts of the country.
That's right. Look, I mean, Rose, this is hard to talk about because it is tragic and it is vicious and it feels deeply un-American. But people are going to die in these detention centers. Families are going to be torn apart by these ICE agent raids all across the country. And the news that we saw in LA isn't just going to be in LA. It's going to be all over the country. So I think there is a real, this is a moment for Americans of all stripes to ask themselves, what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to stand up for our values? And how can I act now in nonviolent, peaceful organizing, using nonviolent, peaceful organizing methods to organize with my community? Because we don't have to just sit back and take this. We don't just have to accept this. We are not powerless in this moment. The number one thing that any would-be authoritarian wants is for all of the residents of a country to feel powerless, for us to believe that he is all powerful. And it is just not the case. It is really not the case. He does not have a mandate for this agenda. People are deeply in opposition to his anti-immigrant agenda, including when he disappears Americans like Abrego Garcia or in his militarization of LA. Even those folks who voted for him or might be somewhat amenable to some of his immigration policies do not like this hyper-militarization that we're seeing from the administration. So as scary as this is, I hope a lot of folks see this and decide this is the moment they decide to reach out in their community and start organizing, because there's an opportunity to push back, but we've got to take that opportunity now.
I'm reading from the LA Times now. Yesterday, heavily armed immigration agents descend on LA's MacArthur Park. Agents on horseback and in armored vehicles participated in a daytime raid in the heart of LA's immigrant community. The LA Times also reports that California and 17 other states threw their support yesterday behind a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of recent federal immigration enforcement raids in Los Angeles, asking a federal court to issue a temporary restraining order against these operations. Before we go to break, Will, what are your bigger thoughts about this bill and how you think the public is going to respond once they learn just how comprehensive it is?
Well, I'm really only qualified to talk about the tax and some of the spending materials, but that's enough. I mean, even beyond all the scary stuff that's just been talked about, and that's tremendously important. If you just look at the what many people may think is boring, which is taxes and budgeting, this is not what the American people want. The polling shows it over and over again that majorities of Democrats, independents, and even Trump voters want the rich and corporations to pay more in taxes, not less. This is absolutely the wrong direction for what the people want in this country. And I just wanted to mention a few things that are in this bill that people may not be very much aware of. One of them is this, what we call the pass-through loophole, which the Republicans falsely describe as a small business tax cut. But actually, 75% of it goes to big businesses. Households with over $1 million of income receive over half the tax benefit. So this is going to huge law partnerships, real estate empires like Trump has. Then there's the estate tax, which is the only curb on the accumulation of dynastic wealth. That's the exemption for that is going up and it's becoming permanent. So it's not going to expire like this one from 2017 was. So now $30 million can be passed down to lucky heirs without a penny of estate tax being paid. So this is entirely the wrong direction. The American people want the rich and large corporations to be paying substantially more in taxes. And this act does just the opposite. It lowers taxes on corporations and the super rich.
And Will, members of the so-called Freedom Caucus wanted the cuts to go even deeper. So Medicaid, food assistance, to pay for all of these tax cuts. But they didn't go as deep as even the Freedom Caucus wanted. And that is why this bill is going to add $3.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. Is that right?
That's right. And running deficits can be a useful thing if you're in the midst of a war or trying to fight a depression. But running a deficit just to give tax cuts mostly to the richest people in the country is a recipe for disaster. It not only is transferring wealth to those who already have a lot of wealth, but higher deficits tend to lead to higher interest rates, which makes everything more expensive that anyone borrows money to buy, like a house or a car or a refrigerator. So it's completely insane, really, and it'd almost be comical if it wasn't so very tragic. This bill answers nothing that the American people actually want and cuts entirely against their interests.
And just quickly, Will, we're going to do another show on this. Can you just talk about how when we say the rich, that has drastically changed over the decades? Because people in this country today have obscene amounts of money that most of us can't even fathom. Can you just talk about how when we say the wealthy, how that has changed over the decades?
Well, we now in this country have about 800 billionaires, and they recently collectively were worth $7 trillion. And then we have another group of what we call centimillionaires, people who have at least $100 million, and that group has grown a great deal. And from a tax perspective, we're not able to tax these people with the rules we have in effect now. The biggest source of income for billionaires and centimillionaires and other hyper-wealthy people is the growth in the value of their assets, of their investments. And unless they sell those investments, they're not taxed on that increase in the value of their of what they own. And you may think, well, where do they get the money to pay for their, you know, pay the mortgage? Well, they can borrow against those increasing assets at very favorable rates. And then when they pass them along to their heirs, all of that increase in wealth that should have been taxed during their lifetimes, that just disappears for tax purposes. So we need basic structural change in how we tax wealth and high income in this country if we're ever going to get billionaires and centimillionaires and huge international corporations to pay their fair share of taxes.
And these are the same people who pay next to no income tax.
That's right, because we're not, the system we have now for taxation does not appropriately or at all touch the main sources of income for the hyper wealthy. And by making the state tax even weaker than it already is, by weakening the alternative minimum tax, which is another thing this bill did, we are just accelerating that problem rather than fixing it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Will Rice, Research Director and Policy Consultant at Americans for Tax Fairness. We're also joined by Shelby Gonzalez, Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible. Today, we are talking about the Trump GOP budget bill, the largest transfer of wealth from the poor and working class to the rich in U.S. history. And just to let you know about votes on this, so no Democrat voted for this bill. In the House, Republican Representatives Thomas Massey of Kentucky and Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania voted no. In the Senate, Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Susan Collins of Maine, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina voted no. But no Democrat voted for it. It passed because they just got enough votes on the Republican side in the House and the Senate. If you have any questions about this bill, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about this bill? What does this say about where we are right now? And we have a lot of people who are on Medicaid who listen to the show, people with disabilities. We've already received emails from people who say they are frightened about what's to come. And we're going to do so many shows with you in mind. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with social service advocates in California to find out how they are preparing. So we're definitely going to do shows about not only you're going to lose your health care, but then what? What does this mean? How are politicians going to prepare for this? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will be speaking with social service advocates in California to find out how they are preparing for the budget bill and what message they would like to send to people who will be affected. Thursday, we'll be talking about cuts to USAID and how this is affecting people around the globe. And if you're in the Bay Area, I hope you can join us on Wednesday night. We'll be doing a live show at the Maine San Francisco Public Library, Understanding the Caregiving Crisis. California State Assemblymember Matt Haney will be on the panel. And now that this bill passed, I am going to ask him about an update to health care for all in the state of California, because that would be one major solution to all of this. That is Wednesday, July 9th. A number of caregiving groups will be sharing resources at 5 p.m. We'll go live at 6, Wednesday, July 9th at the Maine Library in San Francisco. Find more information on our events page, kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the Trump Republican budget bill, the largest transfer of wealth from the poor and working class to the rich in U.S. history, you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible. They were founded in response to Trump's Electoral College victory in 2016. Ezra is co-author of the book, We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. Shelby Gonzalez is vice president for immigration policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Will Rice is research director and policy consultant at Americans for Tax Fairness. We have an email from Julia who said, "Can you talk about Trump's real agenda?" Julia writes, "I think Trump is using the immigration issue to set himself up in a police state. Heavy police presence, plenty of new prisons, opaque processes. Trump's long-term agenda, if he keeps up on this trajectory, is no more presidential elections, extreme top-down administration, control of public information, education, legal systems, textbook stuff, and he's not subtle. Keep the context front and center." So what are your thoughts, Shelby? What do you think is Trump's real agenda and the Republican Party based on this bill?
Well, I definitely think that part of this is continuing to create a rhetoric that blames people who are immigrants and their families for issues that are negatively impacting their lives. So that's part of it. And I also believe that there are individuals within the administration that feel very strongly about wanting to see less people who are immigrants in our nation. And when we step back and think about that, and it is not only focusing in on the rhetoric that has been painted around people, like we're going to be targeting people who are criminals, or we're going to be targeting people who are undocumented. But the reality is that the dragnet is far more vast than that. They are through lots of different mechanisms, not only through this bill, but through different executive actions. There are a lot of people that had an immigration status that are either at risk of losing that status due to different executive actions. When you think about the bill itself and some of the ways that it closes off lawful pathways to immigration, there's exorbitant fees. That's one thing that we haven't talked about yet, but there's some really, really harsh fees that are really out of reach for many, many, many people who are applying, going through the process of applying for lawful immigration status in our nation, including those, who are applying for asylum, for humanitarian parole, for special immigrant juvenile status. There's just unheard of very high fees that really all point towards one key message that our nation is not having a pathway anymore for people who aren't already quite wealthy. So I think that stepping back, I think that there are some benefits to this administration and to Republicans in Congress for finding a group to blame, when there are a lot of people. You've talked a lot, Rose, earlier on about, people struggling to afford their groceries, people struggling in communities in lots of different ways. And there's been a constant drumbeat to kind of blame people who are immigrants in our nation for that, and to cast a very negative light against immigrants. So I think ultimately, there's a big message out there, and that there that immigrants are somehow not fueling our, helping in our communities, which is untrue. There's a lot of positive, a lot of positive attributes that our country has really benefited by having people who are immigrants in our nation. And right now, when we see this supercharged immigration enforcement bill that will put, billions of dollars into investing in family and adult detention centers and super fueling ICE activities. And it's terrifying to see already what has happened and to think about what's to come.
And just to break down the numbers, NPR has a piece about the immigration aspects of this bill. We're talking $45 billion for building new immigration detention centers, $30 billion for mass deportation operations, and to hire an additional 100,000 ICE agents, $46 billion to complete Trump's wall. So these are numbers that we got from NPR. What are your thoughts about their overall agenda and what this really says about their end game, Ezra, Trump and the Republican Party?
Rose, I just have a simple view of this. He's a would-be authoritarian. I don't think it's much more complicated than that. And that doesn't come from me as a grassroots organizer. It comes from the experts in authoritarianism who are watching the decline of American democracy right now. They see in Trump the same the catastrophic actions, the attacks on our institutions that they've seen in other parts of the world. These are Heather Cox Richardson, Timothy Snyder, Maria Stephan, Erica Chenoweth, the brightest lights in the field of anti-authoritarian study. They see what he's doing, and they're focused on these increases in funding for secret police. And what they believe is what I believe, which is, yes, this is an attack on immigrants, but it's not just an attack on immigrants. It's an attempt to create a enormous federal law enforcement agency that answers directly to Trump, and that he can use not to just harass immigrant families, but to go after folks who disagree with him politically, folks who are organizing, folks who are in different political parties. Anybody who thinks that this is just going to stop with immigrants is living on a different planet. I'm sorry. And this is why we believe it is so, so important in this moment not to just say, wow, that's really bad. That's sad and I disagree with it. I guess we'll win in the next election. Don't stop there. Don't stop there, because I can't guarantee that we are going to have free and fair elections in 2026. We should act as if we are. We should organize. We should get behind candidates. We should register voters. We should do the work. But it's very clear to those experts in authoritarianism watching this that that is far from a foregone conclusion. So if you are concerned about what is happening here, if you don't like this bill, whether it's for the Medicaid provisions or the SNAP provisions, you should recognize that members of your own community are going to be directly under threat. And you might not be immediately under threat. I'm talking to the non-immigrants and who are listening right now. You might not be first up, but trust me, you might be second or third or fourth. So for your own community and for yourself, I would highly recommend that folks start looking at what they can do to organize. One suggestion, we're doing a training on nonviolent non-cooperation next week with some of the experts in anti-authoritarianism. We're calling it 1 Million Rising to train up folks around the country about how they can actually organize in their own community. Folks can check it out, see if it resonates with them at indivisible.org. I hope a lot of people figure out what they can do in their own community, whether it's with Indivisible or a local immigrant rights group or a local organizing group. Now is the time to get a little bit uncomfortable and say, you know, I don't think of myself as an activist or a leader or a community organizer. That's okay. We actually need a lot of folks who don't think of themselves that way to start getting in to protect our democracy and their communities.
Well, we did hear that a lot of people who went to those No Kings protests have never been on the streets before. So a lot more people are becoming active. We have a number of other emails. Before we get to those, Will, what are your thoughts about Trump and the Republican Party's real agenda here?
Well, I agree with Ezra. I think he is a nascent authoritarian. And I think that there are some people around him, especially Stephen Miller, who are very scary people, because I don't think they believe in democracy. And they seem to think that the country needs a strong man to bring it back to whatever image they have of what it's supposed to be. And so I wholeheartedly agree with Ezra's recommendation of organize, organize, organize. In terms of tax policy, it's again very simple. Rich people, as a rule, don't like to pay taxes. They pumped over $2 billion into the last elections. Most of the great majority going to Republicans, and a huge chunk of that going to Donald Trump, because the Republicans were promising them the tax cut that they just got. So they're a lot of them are investors. They're used to investing money. So they, you know, individually invested tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in order to get billions of dollars back in tax cuts. So from the perspective that I usually work on, it couldn't really be simpler. It's just give me more money, and the Republicans are happy to do that, and they just did.
We have an email from Connie who says, the rich need to wake up. Everything being covered about the impact of this bill will drive homelessness. Crime will go up if people cannot feed their families. What world do the wealthy want to live in? The money in their bank account is degrading their quality of life and the impact to society. All of us should care, especially the wealthy. I mean, this is a great point, Will. It's so obvious. We're going to see more people on the streets, and we will see crime go up because people need to feed their families.
It is short-sighted. I mean, it depends on what the timeline you're looking at. I mean, if you live in a gated community, you have multiple private jets, you own your own island, say, or you have a super yacht, I think you probably think that you can protect yourself away from general civil unrest. But I think it's been proven in other countries that doesn't work. Eventually, those walls crumble, and people are going to demand some sort of economic justice in this country. So I think they're being short-sighted. I mean, just this puts aside the whole moral question of how they think their neighbors and fellow citizens and fellow residents of this country should be treated. It's short-sighted, and I think some rich people recognize that, and that's why you do have billionaires who contribute to Democratic causes and more progressive causes. But the big bulk of it goes the other side, and it's a short-sighted money grab.
The patriotic millionaires are a group of wealthy people who believe that the taxes should increase. And they write that over the last 50 years, $79 trillion in wealth has been redistributed from the bottom 90% to the top 1%. So, Will, we're going to have you back for another show just to talk about how the tax system has drastically changed. But there are some wealthy people who are speaking out about out against this bill, like the patriotic millionaires, for example.
Yeah, like I was saying, there are people who are very wealthy who also not only have a moral perspective on it that says this isn't right, but also see more long term that a top-heavy economy is not a very stable economy. If you have more and more money that's flowing to the top, and less money in the broad middle class and among working people, that's a recipe for disaster. So I think enlightened, wealthy people recognize that they need to pay more in taxes. We need to have better services. We need to have universal health care. We need to have universal child care. We need all these things that make life worth living, that make a country an attractive place to be. And but we can't rely just on those people. Like Ezra said, we have to rely on each one of us to go out there and learn the facts, make the phone calls, knock on the doors, do what we have to do to organize.
Well, a number of emails, I'll read a few and then we'll get responses. Dan writes, I really don't understand how this is not going to lead to immense Republican losses. That might be to Democrats, but it might also be to an emerging right. How is Trump's base responding? Alicia writes, if Dems regain control in 2026, can this bill be voted down? And then Art says, after hearing what Ezra said about the huge uptick in spending by ICE, don't you think it's time for us to demand from our elected Democratic representatives that they hold public forums in cities across the country that become organizing opportunities that give us the confidence that with citizens acting together for human rights and democracy, we can turn this around? Ezra, what are your thoughts so far about just the Democratic Party overall? I mean, we did a show about Zohran Mamdani's victory in New York City. Democrats, as they always do with these kinds of things, I mean, we saw what happened with, you know, Bernie Sanders. No matter what you think about Bernie, top Dems have not gotten behind his campaign yet. What are your thoughts about, you know, how they're responding to all of this?
Here are my thoughts, Rose. We get the party that we demand. I think it comes down to that. And there is a fight within the Democratic Party right now. There are a set of Democrats who believe that this is more or less politics as usual. Yes, Trump is bad, but we're going to have elections and we'll probably do pretty well. And we can prove that we can work with the other side and we'll get past this. These are the Democrats who are refusing to rally around Mamdani right now. It's not just ideology. It's something more visceral than that. It's something that's small C conservative is how I would put it. They don't want to rock the boat at all. They don't like outsiders coming in. They want people to wait their turn in line. I will say, working with local organizers all around the country, I think the chasm between rank and file Democrats and Democratic leadership has never been as vast as it is today. And that is uncomfortable because I would love a unified opposition party pushing back against this federal overreach. But it's also an opportunity. Because this isn't even particularly ideological. It's not just the left versus the centrist or conservative Democrats. It's people who believe this is a unique crisis for the American Constitution and the American government, and folks who believe this is politics as usual. And Democrats who are just normal rank and file Democrats across the country, they largely believe that we're in a crisis mode right now. And whether they agree on, you know, Medicare for all or a particular education policy or tax policy, they want to see their leaders fight back now. I think there's an opportunity right now as we head into primary season to see more Mamdani wins. Folks who are from the outside who are saying, hey, I'm not beholden to the same interests that got us here. I have a new vision for how the party can actually work in the interests of working class Americans. And I'm going to put my vision forward and challenge the powers that be. I hope we see a lot more of that, not just in New York and not just in blue states like California, but all around the country. The Democratic Party is at 21% approval rating right now in Congress. that's not the kind of popularity we need to take on the greatest threat to American democracy and certainly modern American history. So I would like to see new leadership. And I'm encouraged by the organizing on the ground looking for that new leadership. And I hope that folks who are listening here and folks around the country support that search for new leaders.
Shelby, your final thoughts? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, one thing that keeps on coming to my mind is that how do we use this moment to really not only focus on building back to, you know, where we were before this bill became law? Rather, what do we really want for our nation? What does a more just nation look like? What does a nation that that values people who are immigrants look like? What do laws look like that has a more just tax code and access to services, including food assistance and housing and healthcare? You know, what does that look like, and how do we get behind a policy framework that really sets forward a broad, more bold vision for the future? So that's where my focus has been over the last week, as I also think about the tough work ahead to make sure that, you know, people who are suffering today, people who will be suffering in the aftermath of all of these different policies going into place, are, you know, we do whatever we can to delay and to mitigate some of these harms that are coming our way, at the same time building towards a better future.
Shelby Gonzalez is Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible. Will Rice is Research Director and Policy Consultant at Americans for Tax Fairness. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.